This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Suku Radio. He's the CEO and president of Bankers Trust. Prior to joining Bankers Trust, Radio served as chief financial officer of the Meredith Corporation for 8 years, and he's well known for his commitment to community and has received many honors and awards for his philanthropic work. This Thursday, Radio will be speaking as part of Iowa State University's Stafford Lecture Series. Suku Radio, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
The title of your lecture on Thursday is Banking, an Industry in Crisis. Is it over yet? And before you answer that question, and I do hope you can answer that question, I wonder if you can take us through the financial crisis of 2008 and provide a little narrative about what happened. Remind us what we went through.
Well, you know, if you go back to the period before the crisis, the stock market was up significantly. And perhaps to some extent, we as a country probably became big, fat, happy, and a little lazy. You know, we thought everything was just going to be moving in one direction. And as we all know, the economy has its cycles, and the booms and the busts go back to many, many centuries. And there was probably a whole generation which had not seen anything other than just an uptick in the economy. And we probably were living beyond our means. We also had a tremendous influx of a whole host of new instruments that were being introduced on Wall Street. So there was a lot going on, and the advent of the subprime loans. So, you know, the creativity on the part of the pundits of Wall Street was such that inevitably what was going to happen was the economy was heating up, and we ultimately had a day of reckoning, and we didn't quite initially accept what was going on. We were in denial, and ultimately, of course, it turned out to be a real, real recession, and that's why the term the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. So,
you talked about the cyclical nature of economies, and this is no different. But what set this economic recession apart? What were the unique aspects of it?
Well, I think one really unique aspect was the fact that we had people who were able to borrow well beyond their means and would actually be able to borrow more than what they were paying for a home. And we had this notion that we were going to deliver housing to every American. So as a result, you had a lot of what I would consider marginal borrowers, and hence the term subprime mortgage. And they were borrowing at rates which were exorbitant. And clearly, there was no model that was, you know, whether it was the Federal Reserve or any other model, these econometric models that supposedly predict behavior, etc. Those models, as we found out, the amount of debt that was out there, these models had, they just weren't equipped to factor all of that in. No model really existed that foresaw what was going to happen. So clearly, everybody missed it.
Evaluate how the U.S. government and I guess world financial institutions in concert with the U.S. government, evaluate how they reacted to this crisis.
Well, I think a big chunk of this was initially these so-called toxic assets. You know, Hank Paulson was the Secretary of Treasury, and he convinced George Bush to go ahead with this program where these toxic assets would be purchased from the banks. That was his first reaction. The difficulty is, of course, that these toxic assets would have been impossible to value. And he was, you know, the first reaction was, why don't we just go ahead and buy them from the banks? But I don't think anybody fully understood the depth of the recession. And it would have been, I think, it would have been a cash for trash program. And that just would not have been the intelligent thing to do. Plus, the other thing is that U.S. was considered to be a safe haven for Chinese and Japanese investment. So as a result of that, you would have had a whole, you know, you would have had to deal with all of that also. And so clearly it was a global crisis in some way, shape, or form. But everybody has always felt that our economy was the safest, hence the flight to the dollar, and therefore the treasuries were being purchased by the Chinese and Japanese governments to the point where at one time, I think, they might have had 54-55% of our debt. So clearly, if they would have seen a crisis here, you know, who knows what their reaction would have been. But my suspicion is that, you know, if they had started divesting of some of that at a discount just to get out of the U.S. currency, it would have just made things worse. Mm-hmm. So,
well, what do you see as the most effective measures that were taken to stem the crisis?
I think ultimately the quantitative easing was probably the right thing to do in hindsight. I don't think there's any question about
quantitative
it.
Easing, help us understand that.
Oh, it's basically, you know, it's, in effect saying, okay, let's keep interest rates low. Let's continue a buying program so as a result we can keep rates low and pump more cash into the economy. That's what the Federal Reserve started doing. Ultimately, of course, what that did was it stabilized things. I don't think there was any question about the fact that it stabilized things. It didn't necessarily improve things. You know, you had a massive loss of jobs. Unemployment was higher than it had ever been. But on the other hand, it was one of those where we're going to stem the tide. But keep in mind that at any time you keep interest rates artificially low and you keep them that low for too long, and the Fed would say that the ideal inflation rate ought to be at about 2%, and we are nowhere near that level. So how long do you go on? So at that particular time, it made sense. Does it make sense for a longer period, a sustained period of time? I would argue not. If you look at our savings rate as a country, our savings rate historically has been very, very low. And the velocity of money, as the economists would argue, is what creates consumer confidence, etc. And so when people start saving too much, consumer confidence is down, or people are afraid that one out of every two jobs in the household will be lost. So there are a whole host of other ripple effects at a time when we don't have a lot of confidence in the economy. So in the short run, quantitative easing was the right thing to do and the stimulus in the economy. But in the long run, you also have to make sure that you can't continue to artificially support the economy.
Mm-hmm. So the question you raise in the lecture you're going to be giving on Thursday is it over yet? Does that mean it's over?
I would argue the economy is still sputtering along. I would hardly profess to be an expert in what the stock market is going to do, but I would certainly, I would say that currently where we are, it's probably due for a correction. I don't think we're going to have a major bust, but I do think it's due for a correction.
When we look back at the financial crisis tailing off now, who lost the most and who gained?
J.P. Morgan recently, you know, record fines, $13 billion fine. There are others who are not out of the woods yet. So you take a look at how many different organizations are going to be fined, and the fines will be into the billions. What you see is on the other end, when there was somebody making a lot of money, mm-hmm. and there was somebody who was getting stuck holding the bad paper, and a whole host of investors. So,
But when we talk about that money that evaporated here, those trillions of dollars, whose money was that?
Oh, you know, there were a lot of. This is the old adage about, if it's too good to be true, it is. And there were a lot of individual investors who took a bath. Mm-hmm.
So now what should we take away as individuals, as small investors, take away from this financial crisis? What advice would you give us?
Well, go back to just an example. Bernie Madoff wanted to essentially take all your liquidity, and he would say, you need to invest with me, because I can get you a return much better than what you can get anyplace else. So let's assume for the sake of discussion that you were getting a return of, say, 1 or 2%, and Bernie could get you 10 or 12%. And you basically said, wow, you know, I've got people I know who are wealthy, who are investing with him, and I'm wealthy, so I'm going to invest with him and get a much nicer return. That was obviously not really the case. I come back to, if it's too good to be true, it is. So coming back to reality, if you will, you still have to look at the underlying fundamentals before you go about doing any investing, or you essentially say to yourself, all right, I'm not absolutely savvy enough as a small investor, so why don't I leave it up to the experts? And the difficulty, of course, can be that the experts you look at should be people who are fairly realistic about their assessment, as opposed to saying, let me just tell you, there's so much variability in what you can earn, so why don't I recommend that you do invest your money with a Bernie Madoff type? Mm-hmm. Those things really concern me.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Suku Radia. He is the CEO and president of Bankers Trust. He'll be speaking this Thursday as part of the Iowa State University Stafford Lecture Series. Suku Radia, do you have confidence that the regulations put in place after the financial crisis will prevent something like this happening again?
Well, that's a really good question. And I have to go back to when the stock market crashed, etc. Glass-Steagall basically was a piece of legislation which segregated between the investment banks and the commercial banks. And ultimately, over some period of time, the notion was that maybe we'd gone overboard. So in 1999, 66 years later, we had Graham Leach Bliley, which basically broke down all the barriers. And then we had Dodd-Frank, which put the barriers back in place, so to speak. So, we've come back full circle, so to speak. Take a look at the Enron situation. Post-Enron, we had Sarbanes-Oxley. And there were those who would have argued in Washington that this will basically cure every issue going forward. Corporate malfeasance has continued to take place. So I do come back and say regulation quite often is an overreaction. It doesn't necessarily cure it all. And I know this may sound a little too simplistic, but if you can hire honest management with integrity, your company is going to be fine. So similarly, again, when I take a look at regulation, I still come back with why don't we not be creative? Why don't we try to comply with regulation as opposed to looking for loopholes, if you will? So I'm not sure regulation is always going to be the answer, but I do know that there is always going to be an overreaction on the part of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, if we could, briefly about the debt ceiling, the U.S. deficit, the budget battles going on in Washington. What is your perspective as president of Bankers Trust?
Oh, the debt ceiling is something that's just basically artificial. If you take a look at 19 cents out of every dollar in this country is debt financed, there's 35% of the budget over which we really have any decision making. The rest of the budget is pretty much fixed entitlements and the like. So, sure, I realize that we have to try to live within our means, but perhaps more importantly, as opposed to raising the debt ceiling, the real issue we need to be addressing is how are we going to try and find a way to not continue deficit financing, run deficits every year. That is not a good model in the long term.
What is your prescription for what you think should be done then?
Oh, I think, if you were running your household like that, at some point you would say, I need to find a way to reduce my lifestyle in terms of spending. You can talk all you want about finding new revenue sources and saying we're not going to be able to control our spending, but those revenue sources don't come by that easily. So you just absolutely have to take a look at everything and start spending more intelligently.
What do you see in Washington in terms of the political will needed to do some of the things that you've just mentioned? Do you see that there, or do you see so much partisan rancor that we have this stalemate going on?
Unfortunately, it is the partisan rancor that is very, very troubling. In the old days, they used to be able to cross to the other side of the aisle and iron things out. We don't have that anymore. And that is, everybody wants to kind of take it to the limit. So we basically kick the can down the road and say, well, we'll take a look at this again and let's sit down and talk and let's make sure that by a certain date in January we have a solution. I don't know if we'll really get there, frankly.
Mm-hmm. When you listen to the political rhetoric, as we all do, coming out of Washington, what lines make most sense in terms of creating a better financial future for the U.S. that you hear?
Oh, I don't know that I have really heard anything that makes a lot of sense currently. I do think that Ben Bernanke has an opportunity. I think he's got two more meetings remaining in his position as the chair of the Federal Reserve. I think he would be well advised to raise the rates and tee it up in a better place for Janet Yellen as opposed to having her coming in and raising the rates. I do think that the especially those who live on a fixed income, getting a 0.65% interest rate on 2 to 3 year money makes it very, very difficult for those folks. And if you take a look at bank earnings as such, you could argue with what is going on right now and simply say earnings have restored to really nice levels. So the banking industry is fine. But the reality is a lot of those earnings are one-time type of items. They're not core earnings. They're not repeatable. And I think we will, in the next year, start seeing some of that where earnings will start going down. And then, of course, the very large banks. There was a paper that I read where over a five-year period, there would be about 280,000 people laid off. You get more unemployment. And you also then get into a situation where lending demand is slow. So as a result, underwriting standards get relaxed. And we find ourselves getting back into the same mess because you relax your underwriting standards simply because you want the loan. And you start looking at underwriting standards, which basically, especially on commercial real estate, we should have learned. And I'm not sure we necessarily have.
Suku Radia, we have just a couple of minutes left, but you have such an interesting background. You are originally from Uganda, though. You're not Ugandan. Your family is of Indian descent. Is that correct?
That is correct. Four generations ago.
And your family was exiled from Uganda under Idi Amin. Why?
I came to this country and a year later, I was in college, and a year later, my family was evicted. There were 70,000 Indians in Uganda. They controlled about 95% of the economy in a total population of 7 million. They had been brought there as laborers to build a railroad, and they had opted to stay there at the turn of the century. So I was fourth generation. There were several who were third generation, but the fact of the matter is that when Idi Amin came into power through a coup, ultimately he decided that he needed to provide something back. There were a lot of factions within the army, different tribes. So he wanted to make sure that he consolidated his power. And the best and the simplest answer was take the wealth away from the Indians and redistribute it to the army. Mm. And that's literally what he did. But he was a man with a third grade education and had no respect for human life. So he decided to do that. And basically what happened was that the Indians, who had really no allegiance to India, even though they were Indians, but they had left, you know, three and four generations ago. So they were evicted, and some of them were in denial. They didn't think he would, you know, he gave them a 90-day ultimatum, but there were several who lost their lives in the process because they decided we're not leaving. There's no way. He's going to be able to effect this without some interference on the part of the British. But the British had long since been gone. Uganda was an independent country, so he got away with it.
You came to the United States, and you came to study at Iowa State University, where you graduated from Iowa State University. You had a very humble existence as a college student, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was basically mostly broke after my first year. Didn't get any generous allowance from my family anymore. and tried to rush through college and graduated with $4.87 to my name. We were on the quarter system, and I completed my education in 8 quarters, not because I was smart, but because I had no choice. Otherwise, I would have had to drop out and get a job and then go back and complete my education. And I decided to risk it and went after it with a vengeance.
And you have. So you are the American rags to riches story. We have to add to that philanthropic as well. What advice would you give to youngsters? I know you do a lot of mentoring. What advice do you give to youngsters?
Oh, my advice is very simple. First of all, I always tell them there are no shortcuts in life. Secondly, the most important 9-letter word in the English language is integrity. And thirdly, I think if you look at what's going on today in corporate America especially, we work in teams. So if you are unable to be a part of a team, then you probably will find that you're going to be very, very lonely. So become part of a team, and that means that you really need to hone in on your interpersonal skills, you know, both oral and written skills. I learned the English language as a foreign language. I speak 7 languages, and I know there are people at the bank who tell me it'll be 8 when I learn English. So I kind of look at all of this in the context of saying, you know, learn to make sure you have very, very good communication skills and give it your best. I always tell them there are no shortcuts.
Suku Radia, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us, in English in this case. And we want to remind our listeners that you'll be speaking as part of the Iowa State University Stafford Lecture Series on Thursday. Suku Radia, thank you again.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.